Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is filmmaker Josh Aronson, director and producer of a new documentary about the founding of the Israel Philharmonic called Orchestra of Exiles. There will be a screening tonight at 7:30 at the Mehewi Theater in Great Barrington. It will be a benefit for the Israel Philharmonic. Aronson, who was nominated for an Academy Award in the 2000 film Sound and Fury, is a concert pianist who began his career as a photographer for Time Life. He has since directed music videos, television programs, hundreds of commercials and documentaries. Josh Aronson, what a pleasure. I'm so glad you're here with us.
Thank you, Alan. It's my pleasure.
So I saw the film about the founding of the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra of Exiles, and I got to tell you, I was in love with it. And of course, I don't need to tell you that your finishing flourish in it had me in tears. So I think it was wonderful. What made you do it?
Well, a friend of mine, who's also a pianist, came to me and said that she had a terrific idea for a film. And as a documentary filmmaker who's made more than one film, this happens all the time to all of us. And usually it's someone telling you a family drama or a little story, or someone's dying of leukemia and I should make a film about the year of their death. And you're always very polite. So she's an Israeli woman in her 60s, and I know her a long time, and she's an insurance executive. And she told me that she was working with Joshua Bell, the great violinist, to do a concert in Vienna in honor of Branislav Huberman, who was the founder of the Palestine Symphony. And I said, excuse me, Branislav who? I had never heard of this man. Of course, I knew Joshua Bell. And Palestine Symphony, is that the East-West Divan Orchestra that Daniel Barenboim now has with Palestinian children and Israeli children? I have no idea what you're talking about. And I've been in music my entire life. And I've been a classical musician since I'm 4 years old, but I had never heard what she was about to tell me. She told me that this man, Branislav Huberman, was a great Polish violinist who was a prodigious artist and had, was born in the 1880s. He played for Brahms when he was 12 years old, played the Brahms Concerto. And in the audience were Brahms, Mahler, Richter, and the great luminaries of Vienna at that time. And it launched him. His father took him out of his classes, took him away from his violin teachers. This young man was never schooled again while his father was alive. And for the next decade, they toured across Europe, across America, and his fame grew.
The father lived off Huberman.
The father and the entire family were living off of Huberman. And he used him. It was like a Leopold Amadeus Mozart story. And he used him like a dancing monkey and made money from him.
But he was considered to be such a child prodigy that he could fill concert halls all over the world.
Exactly. I mean, as soon as Brahms dubbed him this luminous young violinist and the reviews started coming in, no one had ever heard a violinist quite like this before. He was playing like an adult. He was playing with a huge sound, and it was an individual sound. And it was like something just coming down and just grabbed him. He was a real, true prodigy and a highly sensitive soul.
And Brahms expected to not like him when he came to hear him, and he loved him.
Exactly. Brahms hated prodigies, and he was dragged to this concert. And he hated prodigies playing anything, but playing the Brahms Concerto, he especially hated. And he loved him. He went backstage, and he wrote a note to him. And I held that note in my hand.
Really?
In the archives. And I must
what
say,
archives?
The archive. There's a Huberman archive in Tel Aviv.
Interesting.
I did most of the research
for
the
Huberman
film there.
A national hero in Israel?
Well, I certainly in the cultural world of Israel, which is getting smaller as it is here and everywhere else, he's very well known and he's beloved as the founder of the orchestra that became the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra. We didn't get to that part yet, but this Palestine Symphony that he founded in 1936, and that's the story of the film, when Israel became a state in 1948, Ben-Gurion changed the name of that orchestra to the Israel Philharmonic.
Now, his relationship with Ben-Gurion in the beginning wasn't all that hotsy-totsy.
That's true. You're very well informed. Ben-Gurion was a man who was obviously dedicated to building the state of Israel. And he thought what was necessary was farmers to come to Israel who would not leave, who would be a dedicated Zionist, who would work the land and would stay and build Israel. And he, of course, was not wrong about that. But he had no interest in cultural musicians coming from Europe. He thought they were very hoity-toity, and they were from Vienna and Berlin. And in 1936, this was a desert. There were camels walking down in through the streets in Tel Aviv. You know, it was mixed with the Arabs, as always. And there were several hundred thousand Jews there. It was hardly a cultural center. And he assumed that these great, great musicians from Europe would want to leave. And he was limited by the British mandate in terms of how many permanent certificates he could give to the artists coming, or to people coming. And he didn't want to waste the permanent certificates on people that he thought would leave. So he blocked it, and he tried to keep Huberman from bringing these musicians and their families. And it became a great battle that's the climax of the film, actually, between Huberman and Ben-Gurion.
Now, in the course of this, what I loved about your documentary was that, of course, the background is the Holocaust.
Well, it's pre-Holocaust, of course. Hitler came in 1933, and that event, Hitler's arrival, and within several months, his starting to fire all the Jews from cultural positions, professors, doctors, and, of course, musicians, were all fired from their position. It was that event that gave Huberman this idea. It was like an aha moment, that in this weird, skewed, horrible world of Nazism, the Jews were no longer employed. So it was an opportunity to get the very best musicians who were now free, to get them and convince them of the danger that was coming and move them to Palestine.
But he was prescient in that he saw it coming.
That's right. That was the extraordinary thing about Huberman. He had lived through pogroms in Poland in the 1890s, and he'd seen anti-Semitism that was even more virulent than they were experiencing in Germany that early in the Nazi regime, 33, 34, 35. It was getting worse, but it was nothing like the Russian pogroms in 1890 in Poland. And he was in rural Poland, so it was horrific. He was born in Częstochowa, about 100 kilometers from Warsaw. So he had it in him, and he'd seen this, and he knew how vile and how dangerous anti-Semitism could get. Plus, Huberman, through his activities in music, had access to princes and kings and the aristocracy of Europe.
They all came to see him.
And then, of course, they wanted to have him over, you know. So he had social relationships with heads of governments. Now, governments knew how dangerous Hitler could be, and they were keeping it to themselves a bit. I mean, they were being very diplomatic. They had diplomatic relations with Germany, and the politics at that time were very complicated. Why didn't Roosevelt stand up earlier? Why didn't Churchill stand up earlier? I mean, the controversies about this are fascinating. I mean, it's been written about Churchill, for instance, that he didn't support the Jews so much because he didn't want to seem as if the effort in England was so supportive of the Jews because he would lose support for the war. And he knew it. So he had to be very diplomatic. So the result was that in private conversations, Huberman learned how dangerous Hitler was. And the fact with the inflation at 1,000% before he came in, he was going to stay for a while. This was a strong man that had come in, and it wasn't going to blow over, which is what a lot of the people thought it would happen.
Tell me about his sense of being Jewish. You know, this is so interesting. I take it you're Jewish.
I have.
You could do some relating to Huberman in this. How much did Jewish identity count to Huberman?
Well, I don't think Huberman was never a practicing Jew. He was very aware of his Jewishness, and he was a cultural Jew, and he was aware of the tradition of Jews playing stringed instruments. I imagine that's the case. He never wrote about being Jewish, but after 33, he recognized the importance of Zionism, and he became a Zionist on his second or third trip to Palestine. He had always been disdainful of Zionism. Like a lot of Jews at the time, they didn't think there was any reason for it. But he got to know Albert Einstein, and Albert Einstein ultimately helped him in the effort to build the orchestra. He raised money with him.
Another fiddle player.
They knew each other through the fiddle, and there's great stories about that. But Einstein recognized with Hitler's ascension how important Zionism was, that Jews needed a state, they needed a safe place. And I think Huberman followed him in that and the importance of it. And he also saw the importance of Palestine and the idea of Eretz Yisrael, because he saw in the kibbutz system something that he loved, which was sort of the pan-European idea of an idealistic getting together of countries to work together, to bond together, to have similar needs, and to share things. This pan-European movement in Europe, which started in the 20s, came after World War I, and he was at the forefront of it. The idea was to avoid World War II. And when Nazism came, it dashed all the hopes of pan-Europa. But he saw the same ideals happening in Palestine in 1931, 1933, 1934, his three trips. And it was very exciting to him to see it working there. So I think rather than a Jewish connection, I think it was more of a cultural connection. It was an idealism that he saw there. He loved the kibbutz system, not because it was Jewish, but because it was social. It was a community. It was socialism at its roots. And I think he connected to that as a politician. And of course, he was a Jew and he knew it. And, you know, it was the beginning of the time where we say even we cultural Jews feel Jewish because of Auschwitz. You know, because of anti-Semitism in the world, Jews who don't practice are still Jews, and they bond with other Jews because of the universal awareness we have of the Holocaust.
Exactly. Now, let me go back to his beginnings when he started to recruit his orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
He had a bit of a life and death, you know, decision to make about who got into that orchestra, because if you didn't get in at one point, you were not going to be saved. You were going to the ovens.
Yeah, that ultimately is true. But of course, looking at history in hindsight is dangerous.
Certainly.
Because the musicians, and most people on the surface, even Huberman, didn't know what was going to happen. No one knew the Holocaust was coming, that the concentration camps, you know, Auschwitz and Dachau and Riga and Theresienstadt, no one knew they were coming.
So what did they think it was going to be rough, but they didn't know that they were going to be executed?
They thought it was going to be a very, very bad bout of anti-Semitism, and the Jews had seen anti-Semitism before. It was a pendulum in Germany for 500 years, and it's written about, in multiple volumes. So these are people who lived there for generations. These are people who were cultural. They were the bankers. They were the doctors. They were the musicians. They were the artists in Germany, as they are, all over the world. Jews are very cultural people and contribute to it. And they're the economic force of Germany at that time. A lot of the Jews were the people running the economy. So they were needed. They didn't want to leave. And even though they couldn't work, they just assumed, as a lot of people did, that these beer hall goons would leave, that Nazism would blow over. Because how could highbrow intellectual Germany, the Germany of Nietzsche, the Germany of Heine, the Germany of Beethoven, and how could they keep these goons there? So no one knew. Huberman had this sense of it, and his role was to pick the very best artist, and he just limited himself to the very best artist, and then try to convince them. And because of his stature as a world-level musician and because of his presence as a politician, people listened to him. And it was extraordinary that he got them to move, because he got very highbrow people, the elite, the musical elite of Central Europe, to move to the desert and to make a commitment and to walk away from generations of their lives there.
Now, some of them went back. A couple of them, as you say in your film,
yes,
went back and made tragic mistakes.
Yes.
Talk to us a little bit about the alternative, so that Jews were not permitted to play in the major orchestras, so something else was developed. Do you want to talk about that a bit?
Sure. In making this film, I researched it for over a year, and all the letters were in German and Polish, so it was a lot of work to get them translated. And as the translations were coming in and I was reading literally thousands of pages, I would cull stories that I was attracted to that seemed like they would be useful in telling the tale. And one story that I'd never heard of, there were many things I hadn't heard of along this, I learned so much making this film, but there was something developed by a man named Kurt Singer. And Kurt Singer was a brilliant man of the time. He was a physician. He was a choral director. He was a opera conductor. He was a theater director. He was a real polymath, as we say. And he saw a possibility in 1933, when the Jews were being fired, actors were fired, dancers were fired, musicians were fired. And at the same time, the Jews were no longer allowed to go to mainstream theaters. So the entire cultural Jewish community was bereft. And he had an idea. He went to the SS and he pitched the thought that, let me organize Jewish performers, musicians, dancers, etc., into a series of cultural theaters across Germany, and we will employ the Jewish musicians and artists, and we will perform for Jewish audiences.
And these were called?
It was called the Kulturbund in German. It's Kulturbund, which means culture society. And it was the Juden Kulturbund, the Jewish Culture Society. Judenkulturbund. And it just fascinated me that the SS allowed this to happen. It was like sort of a parallel universe of culture happening within Germany, which was a Germany that was banning culture for Jews.
What do you attribute that to?
Well, the reasons are complicated, and it makes perfect sense. It was 1933. The war was 6 years away. Hitler had just come in, and the world, in their way, was gradually blasting Germany for its anti-Semitic policies. There were front-page headlines on the New York Times every day about further lists of things the Jews could not do in Germany. They couldn't hold hands. They couldn't date non-Jews. They couldn't teach non-Jews. They couldn't have pets. I mean, there were just demeaning things that were taken away from the Jews. Ultimately, it was a list of thousands of things that Jews were not allowed to do. They couldn't go into public ponds because they didn't want it, you know, defaced by Jewish skin. So the governments around the world were sending, you know, some resistance to this on some level. And the Germans, of course, wanted to keep good relations for as long as they needed to with governments and with people. So they recognized that if they allowed this to happen, it would be good PR. Basically, it was Joseph Goebbels, who was the propaganda minister, who approved it, because it was good propaganda, and that's why they did it.
Now, I couldn't help but be struck by the parallel between that and what happened ultimately at Theresienstadt, where they did similar kinds of things to put this showpiece, basically extermination camp,
yes,
where they were allowed to perform there.
Well, it was the same thing. That was the propaganda that moved into the war.
Yeah.
Because what happened is, of course, in 1939, the Kulturbund had grown, just before the war, after the Anschluss, which is when Germany went into Austria. So the world knew the intentions of Hitler. This propaganda for the world didn't matter anymore. So they simply shut down the entire Kulturbund, and everybody who had been in the Kulturbund was shipped off to concentration camps. Mm-hmm. Now, many of them went to Theresienstadt, which was the concentration camp that they put together as a showpiece for the world. It was their, as you will, prisoner of war camp. And they allowed the musicians, encouraged the musicians to have orchestras there. And they had violins made for them, and they had instruments made for them. And so when the Red Cross would want to check on what was happening in concentration camps, they would clean up Theresienstadt, they would show them all the orchestras, the well-fed musicians that they were performing, and they seemed to be very happy. Of course, what was happening behind the walls was a different story. So Theresienstadt was the propaganda concentration camp, and all these musicians went there. But Theresienstadt was also a feeder for Auschwitz. They would just gradually, over the years, they would just push them to Auschwitz, and they got murdered in Auschwitz. What happened to Kurt Singer, who was the director of the Kulturbund, he believed the entire time that he had a relationship with the SS and that he could negotiate with him and that he would protect his musicians. So when Huberman started poaching the musicians from the Kulturbund to try to convince the best of them to go to Palestine, oddly, this Jewish man, this great, brilliant guy, Kurt Singer, resisted. And he tried to block Huberman because he was, I think, delusional in thinking that he could control the relationship with the Nazis, that he could protect his Jews. And he said, anyone who wants to go with Huberman, I will write you off and write you out of our roles because we need our Jews here to protect Jewish music and German music. And Huberman, of course, thought this was the greatest hypocrisy, and the two of them were flip sides of a coin, and both Jews. And ultimately, of course, Huberman sadly was right because it was shut down in 39. Kurt Singer fled Berlin, and he was caught by the Nazis, by his friends, the SS. They caught him in Holland and sent him to Theresienstadt, where he died. He died of tuberculosis in Theresienstadt.
You're talking to the amazing filmmaker, Josh Aronson. It is a film that I just want to encourage everybody to get to see. It's just fabulous. And the name of the film, of course, is Orchestra of Exiles, a wonderful documentary. So, Josh, what is the website that everybody can go to learn more about the film?
There's a website for the film called orchestraofexiles.com, just like it sounds, one word, orchestraofexiles.com. And on the website is both a promo, which will tell you the story of the film in 9 minutes with just talking heads, and the trailer that we've just completed for the release of the movie in the fall is on there as well. So you'll get a taste of the movie, 2 minutes of it.
Well, you've done a lot of films. Are you proud of this one?
Oh, this one is a piece of my heart. Orchestra of Exiles took 3 years to make. The reading and the engagement I had to have with the material was a life experience. As a Jew, I was interested in really immersing myself in the literature of the Holocaust and the literature of that time. And I had never really done in-depth reading of that material, and I wanted to do it. And it was the moment in my life that I could spend a year reading all the books and reading all the letters. And it was so touching and so tearful, I can't even begin to tell you. And then on top of it, in making the film, I got to meet the aristocracy of Israel, the people in there, the octogenarians who remembered, who were there in the 30s, who talked about Zionism at the beginning. And, you know, these are beautiful people who remember what the dream of Israel was. Israel is so controversial today because of the politics and the right-wing government. It's very difficult to see Israel as it was meant to be in the beginning, and we hope it gets back to
those
things.
It was a socialist
country. It was.
And the Soviet Union endorsed it.
They did, and the first Jews that came from Moscow. They came from Russia, and then finally they started coming from Europe in the late 19th century, and then up until 1917 there were hundreds of thousands of Jews there, and then with the British mandate they only continued to come under the jurisdiction of the British. But getting back to what this film meant to me, meeting these people, interviewing the greatest musicians on earth, because Zubin Mehta's in the film, Itzhak Perlman's in the film, Joshua Bell is in the film, and Pinchas Zukerman are in the film. Yeah. And these are men who make music at the highest levels.
And their insight into Huberman was great in terms of, you know, what a great rock star of classical music would be experiencing and what they had to say about basically what was happening to them, so they understood what was happening to him.
Sure. I mean, there's that section in the film when Huberman is 14. We have three Hubermans in the film, and one of them is a 14-year-old who plays Huberman at that age, and we see him, and the kid we hired from Berlin actually plays. He's a prodigy at this day. And we have Pinchas Zukerman talking about what it is to be a prodigy and the parent pushing him and taking him by the ear and forcing him to go out there. And Pinchas said, I can say immodestly that I had some of that experience myself.
How much does it cost to produce a film like this?
I guess the answer to that is a moving target. One can make a film and you have people, sure, kids coming out of school making films for nothing, you know, in that everything is digital now. This film cost more because I wanted to have recreations with actors woven through the film.
Are we talking millions?
Not millions, no. Okay. Less than millions.
Okay.
Less than millions.
And you have to go to people to get that money?
Yeah, I raise the money from foundations. Well, typically for films like this, because it's an audience of people that are interested in Holocaust education, and this film will have a long life in universities and schools.
And it should.
Thank you.
It's wonderful.
Because Huberman was a hero. Huberman stood up against intolerance as he saw it. He walked away from a career in Germany that was his most lucrative market. And as Hitler came in, he cut all of his ties with Germany and would never play there again.
And he was an amazing man in that he was not desirous of personal attention, so that in that original concert, which will bring tears to everybody's eyes, you would have thought that maybe he would get up, and he got Toscanini to be the conductor, but he did not solo in that. And he is one of the world's, if not the world's greatest violinist at the time.
That's right. He refused to solo because he wanted the orchestra to be the star.
Talk to us about Joshua Bell. This is an incredible story. In fact, we have a regular program here on WAMC with the cellist Yehuda Hanani. Mm-hmm. And Yehuda Hanani, of course, is Israeli, and he was brought out of Israel to come to the States by Isaac Stern and by Leonard Bernstein. And he came in here, and he started to talk about Huberman one day. Yes. So Huberman is obviously of great importance to Israelis who recognize what his contribution was. But I guess I wanted to ask you about the story of Josh Bell and the magic violin. Can you tell us about that?
Well, in the film, there's a remarkable story. Huberman in 1936 was $80,000 short. to, you know, raising money. So he decided to do a tour across America to raise money. So at that time, with trains and buses and whatever it took, he did 40 fundraising concerts in 60 days. Now, you can imagine in 1936 what that took for a man in his late 40s who was never a well man. It just took everything out of him to do so many concerts across the country. But they started the tour at Carnegie Hall in 1936, and Huberman had two violins. He had a Guarnerius, which was a very valuable, wonderful instrument, but his most beloved instrument was a Stradivarius that had been given to him when he was 9 years old by a Polish count because he was such a wunderkind, as they said, and he gave it to him. Now, this was quite a gift. So it was the primary instrument that Huberman learned on and played on for his entire career from 9 years old until his late 40s, when this in 1936, actually early 50s. Now, he was using the other violin for the piece he was playing on the stage, and someone snuck into his dressing room, which had been left open, and stole his Stradivarius. And that instrument, it's a long story, but just to cut to the chase, the man who stole that instrument never tried to sell it, never tried to do anything with it. He actually played it for 50 years.
And how do we know this?
Well, we know this because on his deathbed, he told his wife that the violin that he'd been playing all those years, he got in a somewhat illicit way. And he instructed her, we don't know the words because nobody was there, to get it back in the world, that it was an important violin. Now, that violin by then was almost black because he had never taken it in to maintain it or to have it cleaned or to be adjusted, because any violin adjustment person would know immediately that it was a Stradivarius, and any Strad that gets stolen is listed. So it had virtually disappeared for 50 years. And no one knew where it was. Huberman died in 1947. The years went by. And all of a sudden, 1990 or something, this woman brought it back and found out that Lloyd's of London technically owned it because they paid the insurance to Huberman in 1936. So she got it back to Lloyd's of London. They had it cleaned up, and they sold it to the famous violinist named Norbert Brennan, who was the violinist of the principal violinist of the Amadeus Quartet. And they were all Germans who'd left Germany about the same time. So it went from Huberman to this man who played it gigging in New York for 50 years, and then back to a great violinist, Norbert Brennan. And Joshua Bell bought it from him in the early 90s, I think. And so Joshua Bell has been playing Huberman's violin for years. And he tells the story of how it was so perfect that that was the violin that he could get and that he fell in love with, because it was his teacher's favorite violinist. And Josh Bell grew up with a picture of Huberman on the wall in the studio where he studied his entire life. He now owns that picture, and it's in his living room.
And he owns the violin.
And he tells great stories about it, and he was a great support to us, and we have a wonderful interview with Josh. And I have footage of Josh playing the Brahms concerto with that violin, and it matches one of the early scenes in the movie of Huberman playing that violin at that event with Brahms. Because by then, Huberman had that violin. So Brahms heard him play that violin, and then we, at the end of the movie, we have Josh Bell, sort of the Huberman incarnate, playing the same piece.
Wow. And, of course, the tears are rolling at that point. Yeah. You can't avoid it.
By the way, the other violin, the Guarneri, is now played by Midori.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, so she has his other violin.
So do you ever feel you channel Huberman? You're so close to him. You've looked at every bit of his being brought up. You clearly didn't like the father that much. You know, that comes through. You don't have to be a genius to figure it out. But do you ever feel that you're channeling him in any way?
Well, you know, I wrote a script for the film. The film is basically made up of a narrator who weaves through the film, a generic narrator. And then a lot of voices. We have the voice of Huberman. We have the voice of his assistant. We have the voice of his wife. We have the voice of his father. There's many, many voices in the film, including Furtwängler, the great conductor, and Goebbels' voice, and etc. And I cast people for those voices. But the script was written, and it was based on letters. It was based on the letters that I found and had translated. And so after spending a year in my office in Rhinebeck, looking over the Hudson River, working with this material, you're right. At a certain point, I felt, can I take a little license here to make the transition better? And I actually felt comfortable that I knew what Huberman would have said, and I had his syntax down. He spoke extremely formally. The German that he wrote in was a very formal, old-fashioned kind of German. And people who were translating it said, you know, I told them I wanted an exact translation, so I really had the sense of how he spoke. And they all said the same thing, that it was very difficult to read his work because it was just so so flowery and formal in the old German way. And but I took the liberty of making transitions and writing things for him and imagining things that he might have said in certain circumstances where I had to. I mean, I hate to admit it, but it's true. Every single word was not Huberman's. But I feel very confident that I didn't go anywhere that he wouldn't have gone, and I didn't say anything he wouldn't have said.
Josh Aaronson, are any of your relatives, older relatives, still alive?
Well, my mother is still alive.
And what does she think of this?
Well, my mother is, well, she's a nice Jewish mother. She's very proud of me. She watched the journey, and as you said earlier, I was nominated for an Academy Award, and when she saw this one, she said, "This time you'll win." But that's not when we make these films. She's just immensely proud of me, and my father was very connected to that period. He was very connected to Israel.
What was he like?
Well, my father was a Russian Jew who came. He was born in this country, but his parents were from Vilna, which is the center of sort of cultural Judaism at that time. And they came over in the early 1900s, and he was of that generation that would never buy German after the war. He would never go to Germany. He never set foot in Germany.
My father wouldn't get in my Volkswagen.
Yeah, wouldn't. Same with me. I had a Volkswagen when I was a kid. My father wouldn't get in it. He didn't like the fact that I had it. And people have asked me, what was my experience as a Jew in Germany now? And, you know, it's a totally different universe now. I mean, Germany is filled with people like everywhere else in the world who look back and say, how could this have happened? And what was going on with our country that allowed this to happen?
And of course, and you believe it?
I do believe it, very much so. I have very close friends of my generation in Germany. The interesting thing is I've run into a number of people who are finding out that their parents dissembled. They didn't tell the whole truth.
Oh, indeed.
About, you know, what they were doing during the war. Yeah. And a friend of mine is doing a film now about his family because his father had always asked, and all of his father's generation had asked, and his father would be in his 60s, 70s now, and asked what you were doing in the war, and there was a lie told, and it was covered up. His father had been a Nazi, and now his father died, and they found out after his death, so the entire family is dealing with this, and what does this do to you? To know that your father was, you know, not the obstructionist, was not in the resistance, he did not, whatever. They knew that the father had continued his position as an educational minister. He survived very well through the Nazi era, and afterwards he's saying, well, I had nothing to do with him. Not possible. You couldn't have survived that well and functioned as a minister in Germany if you weren't a collaborator or a Nazi, and his father was. And I've heard several stories like this. But this generation, they're looking at that with as much horror as we would.
And so, how about Vienna? Did you spend any time there?
I spent a little time in Vienna.
I felt the anti-Semitism in Vienna was much more palpable than it was when I was in Germany.
You mean today?
Yes.
Today.
I mean today.
Well, you know, I must say I was there days at a time, so I didn't have any interaction with people. Mm-hmm. But I've heard that. And in Poland as well. A lot of people in Israel, you know, when they knew that I filmed in Warsaw and in Częstochowa, they go, why would you want to go to Poland? Why would you want to go? There's anti-Semites. And they used all kinds of words to describe the Poles. I was amazed. But it was universal. There was a real distaste for Poland in a sense that there's real anti-Semitism there, much more than in Germany. You're absolutely right about Poland and Vienna in that sense.
What do you hope this film is going to do?
Well, aside, of course, from the hope that, you know, it is released in the theaters and lots of people get to see it in the theaters, because that feels good as a filmmaker, it's going on PBS. PBS loves it, and 13 has embraced it completely in their...
Channel 13 in New York.
Channel 13 in New York, which is the PBS station. And they're presenting it to PBS, and hopefully they'll take it as a national broadcast in its full length, in the 85-minute length, which is very unusual and just fantastic if they do that. And
They better.
Yeah, it's going to be hard to cut it. 13 says they will show it in New York. They guarantee it as a feature, but they're going to push PBS to do it as well because they love it. So that's all great. It couldn't be better. I have a wonderful distributor. It'll be in the theaters starting late October in New York and Los Angeles, and then it'll go across the country. Beyond that, one of the things that will be vital with this film is that our outreach program and our educational program with it and our study guides that we create to go with it will be used in an evergreen way. They'll go to schools and they'll go to universities. Facing History, the organization that archives history, Jewish history and Holocaust history, they're encouraging me to make versions that would be appropriate for elementary school kids. That would be difficult. They would have to cut it down to a series of half-hour shows. But they think that the lessons in this film, both for university students, for people of all, you know, levels of education, high school students, this is a story of men. There are three of them mentioned in the film, but primarily it's Huberman and Toscanini. They stood up against intolerance. They saw what was happening
Toscanini
in Germany.
Toscanini was really something, wasn't he?
Toscanini was just like Huberman. That's why Huberman invited him on board, because of his stand against Nazism and because he refused to play in Germany. Just as
Hitler wrote him a letter, according to your film, and asked him to come and conduct a major symphony in Germany, and he said no.
He absolutely said no. And
can you imagine getting a letter from Hitler?
Well, he had it translated word for word from German into Italian to make sure he understood every word. He was a very careful man. And we have a scene of him sort of walking back and forth in his study, you know, as the music is building a little bit. But he basically immediately knew he would not do it. He had accepted the gig before Hitler came into power, and when Hitler came to power, he canceled. He said he was not coming. And Winifred Wagner, who was Wagner's daughter, she had booked him to be at Wagner's theater in Bayreuth, Germany, and she was so upset that he wouldn't come that she went to her friend Hitler and asked Hitler to write this letter. And we had the letter. You see the letter in the film, and I can't say that I held that letter in my hand. That one would have been creepy. But it exists, and we got a scan of it. So we have the actual letter with Hitler's signature on it to Toscanini. So indeed it happened. And Toscanini said no, and that made world news. And Huberman immediately wrote him and told him about the orchestra and the project he was doing and invited him on board. And the reason for it, we haven't touched on this, the reason for that partnership and the underlying reason behind Huberman was political, that he viewed this orchestra not just as an orchestra of men whose lives he'd saved, but it was political in that it would be an orchestral body that would use music, the power of music, to fight Nazism and fascism. And in their mind, they didn't have machine guns, they had music, and they had music at the highest level. And they would show the world that you can take these exiles, these thrown away Jews from these great orchestras and put them together, and they could make music on the highest level. And what hypocrisy it was of the Nazis to have done this.
You know, Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger both had instruments which said this instrument fights fascism.
Yeah,
and this
really?
Is precise. Oh yes,
I never knew that.
Yeah, that exists on Pete's banjo now, and Woody had that on a guitar.
That's a great story.
So it's pretty much along the same lines of what they were expected to
do.
Well,
if we can use the arts to fight, you know, oppression and intolerance, what better way to do it?
So, Josh, I can't get enough of Huberman. You know, after I saw the film, I just kept walking around and muttering the name Huberman, you know, almost as if it was a jingle, Huberman, Huberman. This guy really had this passion. Those of us, you said, cultural Jews who grew up in homes where our parents may not have gone to a synagogue more than a few times a year, if that, you know, but this guy was in that group, wasn't he?
Very, very much so. Very much so. You know, he had this passion for this orchestra. And one of the reasons, I mentioned one reason, because he saw a way to get the Jews out and he could get them to work and get them to Palestine. But the reason was when he went to Palestine in 1929, he had never seen audiences like that. There was so much heat for music, so much thirst for music, that he was taken by it. And the reason for it was that those early Jewish settlers, there were hundreds of thousands of them, coming from Russia, coming from Europe, in the early days, they'd been professors and doctors and cultural people. Now they were farmers and they were working and they were true Zionists, but they had brains and they were highly educated. They missed culture. And he felt that.
And he wanted to give them something back too.
That's
I mean, you could get the elite in the concert hall, but he gave these workers' performances. What were they like?
Well, he recognized that the cost of tickets in Palestine, like anywhere, was more than most people could afford. So it was the elite who were coming. So he went to the presenters and he said, I want to give a series and I'll donate my services. I want to give a series of concerts for the workers, for the field workers, for the the babysitters, for the the underlings in culture who want to come, because he could feel it and he could tell so many people were turned away, and he gave concerts for 1/5 the price of the regular concerts, and he did that throughout his career in Palestine, 3 or 4 different tours in Palestine.
And you have great film of that.
Yeah. And then when he started the orchestra, he convinced Toscanini to do it. So after the first 4 regular concerts where all the hoi polloi of Palestine would come, and Golda Meir was there, sure, and all the fancy people were there, and they paid for the tickets, and there were thousands of people that did, he gave a series of concerts for workers. And the tickets were so valuable, and everybody wanted them, that you had to show your identity card with the ticket to show that you, in fact, were a worker, or that you were someone who couldn't have afforded one of the other tickets. And the Palestine Symphony did that for years. It was very, very important to him that the culture should have music. And along the same lines, he insisted that all of his players from Europe teach, because he recognized that this was the beginning of this country, and they had to continue. They had to pass it on, and they had to build the culture. And he brought the best musicians from Europe, he brought the culture from Europe, and they had to pass it on. So everyone was required to teach. And that was the legacy that Pinchas Zukerman talks about, and others that I've talked to, Itzhak Perlman talked about it, that though their teachers weren't these people, it was their students of those teachers who were. And it just passed on that way. And the culture of Israel that we know today, which goes everywhere, which is vast, which is the opera and the ballet, and certainly the Israel Philharmonic is one of the great orchestras of the world, it comes from Huberman. Huberman brought it.
Mehta. Yeah, you interviewed him. Mm-hmm. He's not Jewish, took on the conductorship of this orchestra. What was that all about?
Well, he was hired as a guest conductor in his 20s. He was a brilliant, very beautiful young Indian from a famous family, the Mehta family. And he came and he fell in love with Israel. And the orchestra fell in love with him. It was just like it was a repeat of what had happened in 1947 when the 27-year-old Leonard Bernstein came to the Palestine Symphony before Israel. And they fell in love. And Bernstein went for 25 years and then took that same orchestra around the world with Isaac Stern. And they made it famous, and they made it great. They filled in the holes that Huberman hadn't been able to get players in the wind section at quite the right level, and there were little details. And it had great fame. And then in the 60s, Zubin Mehta came as a guest conductor and fell in love with it. And the orchestra fell in love with him. He loved Israel, go figure. He was a very, a highbrow aristocratic Indian, highly educated, wonderful family, wealthy family, and he loved Israel. And though he was conducting around the world, he kept coming back to Israel. He made himself always available to the Israel Philharmonic. And then they made him conductor for life, artistic director for life. And he has been there as the music director of the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra for 45 years. It's astounding. There's no other story like it in music. And to this day, when the orchestra is a unique orchestra in that they run themselves. There's no management board. The orchestra players themselves run the orchestra. So if they decide they're going to do a benefit concert, they call up Zubin, and Zubin follows. So it's a very symbiotic relationship among the players and with Zubin.
There's a very famous story, I have no idea if it's apocryphal or not, about Barenboim deciding that it's time for the Israel Philharmonic to play Wagner. And some of the people in the audience were very upset, and the newsreel showed people throwing chairs. What was that about?
Well, obviously, Wagner was one of the great anti-Semites of the century.
Terrible.
And worse. Hitler embraced his music and used the music of Wagner as a sort of a theme song for Nazism. So it became so associated, and his anti-Semitism was so associated with the Holocaust and with Nazism, that many Jews afterwards were repelled by the idea of Wagner. And certainly, right after the war, so many Holocaust survivors went to Israel. Just out of sheer respect for them, they banned Wagner, and Wagner was never played. And then sometime in this, I guess the 70s?
Yeah, probably.
Daniel Barenboim, who was a well-known world-level conductor and pianist, guest artist at the Israel Philharmonic many times as a pianist and as a conductor, said, this is one of the great musicians of our time, of the past several hundred years. His personal opinions, his politics are not important but the music should be heard. And I'm going to play Wagner. I'm going to be the one to break it. But out of respect, he announced it, and he said it's going to be an encore piece. It will be a short encore piece played of Wagner. And if anyone in the audience has objections, now's the time to leave. And in fact, some elderly people walked out and left. I never heard anyone throwing chairs. I don't think you could throw chairs because they're bolted to the floor at Mann Auditorium. But it was very controversial, and the throwback was not great. And I don't think he did it often, if he did it again. But I thought he was very respectful in announcing that he was going to do it and giving the audience the opportunity to leave if they wanted to. And they say that some people left. Beyond that, I think it's gotten over-dramatized.
I can well understand. So when you assemble a piece like this and you get the Pinchas Zukermans and the Joshua Bells and everybody to commit to it, is that hard as the director, as the creative director of a film like this, to get them, or were they anxious to do it?
Mixed. It's very hard because these are, you know, hugely busy people.
Sure.
And they know, I mean, Josh Aronson is not a household name, although in the documentary world, I've made a number of documentaries.
Damn well should be.
Thank you. You know, when I call and I, you know, show up, and in this case, I showed up more or less at the offices of the American Friends of the Israel Philharmonic. And through them, you know, I you know, they were cool and they liked the idea, but they didn't know what I would do. And, you know, I was trying to raise money from people that they want to raise money from. So there was some interaction there. But they saw that I kept showing up. I found over the years with documentaries, if you keep showing up, people notice that you keep showing up. I think that's half the...
Well, what do you mean by that, keep showing up?
Well, I mean that you don't give up, that you keep coming, that it's clear. It becomes clear that you're very serious and your intention is very serious to make this film. And as people get to know you, they realize that you're not an idiot.
Well, how does a Joshua Bell get to know you, or a Berenbaum, or any of these folks?
Well, they don't get to know you. Their people get to know you.
I see.
So in this case, I finally met Avi Shoshone. Avi Shoshone is the general secretary of the Israel Philharmonic. He wasn't so hard to get to. I called up through the office in New York, and they said I was this guy, and I was serious, and he made an appointment with us. And he was very cordial, but very cool, and said, we'll give you support, we'll give you all the help we can, and we'll give you the music of the Israel Philharmonic. Right away, he offered that. If you finish the film and you need our music, we will give it to you, because this is our story. And then over the course of the film, it would come up and I would ask for things and I would be in Israel. I would always go see him and let him know. He gave us permission to film in the auditorium. And at a certain point, I said, we need an interview with Zubin Mehta. And it took about 6 months to get it scheduled. But and we were willing to meet him anywhere in the world. And he finally scheduled it. He'd heard from other people that I wasn't embarrassing to people. And he scheduled that interview. Pinchas Zukerman, I have musical contacts in the world in New York. And through various people, I got his email address, and I started just emailing him directly. And lo and behold, one day he responded.
Really?
And he agreed to do it. And we just set a date, you know, at the Manhattan School of Music where he teaches in New York, and he gave me 3 hours. It was a 3-hour interview. And he was totally entranced because he knew the material and he loved it. He wanted to do it. It was clear that he wanted to be part of it. Now, once I had, Josh Bell, I got even earlier because Josh was going to do this concert. If you remember in the beginning, the woman who, Dorit Strauss was her name, who had given me the story, told me the story, was producing a concert with Josh Bell to commemorate her father and Huberman. Now, her father is in the, she's in the film telling the story. Her father was saved by Huberman in 1936. Her father was a student of Huberman's, and he took him and parents and family to Palestine, and thus saving them. And Dorit is the daughter. So she gave me the story because she felt it was time that everyone know who Huberman was, and she told me this amazing story. Well, Dorit had somehow engaged Joshua Bell, paid him, to play in the Grand Synagogue of Vienna. And she invited me to come and shoot the concert. And once we talked about what the film would be, I realized that that concert would be useful for us as a sort of a crawl, you know, of titles at the end. So, but at the same time, we asked for an interview with Josh because he had the violin. And he agreed. And just because I also knew Josh Bell. I've known him for some years.
How'd you know?
I'm married to a concert violinist named Maria Bachman. And she's known Josh since they went to summer camp together. So, I just knew him through the world. And his pianist some years ago was a very close friend of mine. And we went to concerts, several concerts at Carnegie, and went to dinner with him afterwards. And I got to know Josh. He's a very nice guy. Very open and gives great parties in New York. So he knew me, so that was easier. But then at the end, we wanted Itzhak Perlman, and Itzhak Perlman knew that Pincus was in the film and Zubin was in the film, so we were sort of grandfathered in. I suspect that, you know, since it was a film about the Israeli Philharmonic, about Huberman, and Zubin was in and Pincus was in and Bell was in, Itzhak knew he had to be in it.
Is there anything in the film that you second-guessed yourself on? In other words, is there anything going back that maybe you would change a little so you could use something else? Because you've told us many stories today that are not in the film.
That's true. That's true. You know, when you make a film and you have a vast ocean of material, you have to be very selective. You can't tell all the stories because then you end up with nothing.
Yeah.
This was a very complex story.
There was one thing, and let me interrupt for one moment because we're running out of time, but at the very end there's a scroll in which you say, or some writing, which you say, Huberman saved over 1,000 Jews.
Almost 1,000.
Yeah, 1,000 Jews. So, and some of those were Jews who were not being brought over for the orchestra, but who he was saving otherwise. But, you know, does the film really tell us enough about them, or is that another film?
Well, that's a very good question. I had hoped to find two or three people who had been saved by Huberman who are still alive today. I found one, and there's a wonderful interview with her. Her name is Rosie Grunschlag, the sister of Dorit's father.
I remember it's that.
Complicated to try and tell the story. But, you know, she gives a wonderful interview about being saved by Huberman in 1939, which is after the orchestra had started. And there's someone in the film who tells the story of how that happened. Once Huberman had these contacts all over the world, and he had been getting certificates to get the Jews into Palestine, he had a network of people, and he had passion, and he had entree. So when people asked for help, whenever he could, he helped. And he never kept records. No one kept records because, as you said, he didn't want a pat on the back. He didn't need the accolades. He was already world famous. He was doing it because he was a big heart and he could save Jews. And so some people say he did that so much that they guesstimated that he saved 3,000 Jews. Some people in Israel use that number. Others said, you know, he brought hundreds of Jews to Palestine for the orchestra, which would be the players and the wives and the children. We know about that. 3,000 felt an awful lot. It seemed like 1,000 was more likely, so I really just threw a dart and just picked it because I didn't want to be so outlandish. But it seems clear to most people that he saved almost 1,000 Jews. No one will ever know the number. But he got them to England. He got them to Norway and Sweden. He got some to America. And people say, why didn't they all just leave? It must have been hard to get out. That was the problem. It was the reverse. It was easy to get out of Germany until 1938. You could get out.
Sure. They wanted you out.
You just couldn't go anywhere. No one would take you. America wouldn't take the Jews, and England wouldn't, and Switzerland wouldn't, and France wouldn't. Shanghai would, if you wanted to go to Shanghai. That was a big jump from Vienna. But Huberman could get you in, and that was the critical part, to get papers in.
Well, Josh Aronson, I can only tell you how much I have personally enjoyed this. I'll give you a little insight. I've enjoyed it as much as anything I've ever done. And I just can't thank you enough for giving us all of this time. The other thing I think that comes out of this is that a lot of people, as you said in the beginning, have no idea who Huberman was. And now they do. Mm-hmm. And he's going to be, as a result of this film, my view is that he's going to become known to a lot of people who should have known about him.
Yeah, thank you. You know, his albums are available, by the way, because his music is available, too. Bronislaw Huberman, and you can find him on the internet, and there's old albums, and his music is out there, and it's just wonderful to hear it.
Josh, let's have your website address one more time so people who love this interview, as I have, can find out even more.
You can find out more about the film at orchestraofexiles.com. There's information there, and there will be a schedule of screenings across the country, although we haven't organized it yet because it's not really starting until the fall. But the promo is there, and the movie trailer is there, and it's orchestraofexiles.com. And we're on Facebook at Orchestra of Exiles. So if you like the interview and you're interested, please like us, send it out, and help us build the word.
There will be a screening tonight at 7:30 at the Mehewi Theater in Great Barrington. It will be a benefit for the Israel Philharmonic. I hope that if you can get a ticket, you'll be there.
You've been been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.